Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Shlom. Longtime listeners to this show probably know I have a lifelong fascination with what lies out there beyond our planet. How big is the universe? Where did it come from? And does it even make sense to ask questions like that? Our guests certainly think so. Tim James is the author of the new book, Astronomical, From Quarks to Quasars, The Science of Space at its Strangest. It's a very fun read that covers virtually everything that has a high fascination factor when it comes to the study of the universe, astronomy. James' previous two books make this the completion of a trilogy. His first book, Fundamental, deals with our understanding of the tiny world of quantum physics, which is the basis for our tech-driven civilization. The second was Elemental, a look at the periodic table of the elements and the matter that makes up pretty much everything in our lives. Astronomical is one of the most engaging and delightful science books I've read in years, and we're joined now by its author, Tim James. Tim, welcome to Blue Dot.
Good morning. Good morning. It's a pleasure to be talking to you.
I'm looking at this book and I've enjoyed it very much, and we'll get into it in a bit. But it's the third part of a trilogy. You had the first book was Fundamental, which is about quantum mechanics, which is very fascinating. And then you wrote Elemental, which is about the periodic table of the elements and how they, you know, we are all made of those elements. And now Astronomical. Could you tell us about did you have in mind to do this trilogy, or did it just kind of unravel organically?
Sort of somewhere between the two, actually, sort of a hybrid. Obviously, I sort of in my mind when I was writing the first one, kind of imagined we could expand this and go out further and further. You know, you start with simple sort of structures, simple particles, then you go to elements and atoms and molecules, and then as you go further out and further out, I just thought, well, what's the biggest thing to do, which would be space. But it was also sort of an organic thing, because the first book, first two books did very well, especially in America, so thanks guys, did really well in America. And so the publishers just sort of said, okay, what else have you got? And then they said, well, you know, we'd love you to write a book on space. I said, I'd love to write a book on space. I was hoping you'd ask for that. So kind of halfway between, I was sort of in my head planning it as a series, and sort of hoping that I would get invited to do it. And I was very fortunate, and to the publisher said, oh, how about a space book? And I thought, yes, point me in the right direction.
Well, they're really well written, and they're so
entertaining.
Thank you,
that's pretty kind of you.
They're very entertaining. They're not just informative. They're fun to read. And so like for me, you know, this is a topic that I'm pretty familiar with, but I was just thoroughly entertained, and I was surprised at how entertained I was. So it was really a delight to read.
Well, thank you. You know, that's an enormous compliment, actually, because to sort of hear someone who's obviously main passion is space, astronomy, astrophysics, cosmology, to hear that I'm not just boring you and you're not just reading it going, yeah, I know that. It's nice to know that even someone who is well-versed in it is still finding things that are kind of sort of fun and entertaining. That's really quite a compliment. One of the sort of most nerve-wracking, but wipe your forehead and say few moments so far of my writing career is with the quantum mechanics book. I got an email from a guy called Professor Charles Antoine, who is a professor of quantum physics in France at Sorbonne University. Sort of that's like sort of the French equivalent of Harvard and Yale, sort of Ivy League. And I got this email from him, and I thought, oh no, he's about to rip the book to shreds, and he's about to say, you got this wrong, and page 67 is this error. And fortunately, he said, oh, I really enjoyed it. It was very entertaining. So I've been overwhelmed, and I'm very grateful at the response, because I've had both complete newcomers to sort of science topics enjoy it, and people such as yourself who know what they're talking about sort of say that they found it fun. So it really is a massive compliment, and I don't take it for granted. So thank you very much for saying that. That's really, really, really appreciated. Thank you.
You're welcome. And the biggest compliment I can pay you is my thought was, as soon as I finish, is who am I going to give this to?
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
Well, Christmas is around the corner, folks, and I will gladly take your money.
There's so many people that I know that, you know, they're interested in space and astronomy to an extent, and they don't know a whole lot about it, but they find it interesting. And I thought, this is the perfect book for someone like that, because it's not, you know, It's something that you can read in a weekend of dedicated reading. It's not super long. It's very entertaining, and it covers all the really cool stuff.
Thank you. That was absolutely the aim. The aim was to try and be like an all-in-one space book that's all the stuff people want to know. So it focuses on the weird bits of space, black hole, string theory. I'd try and touch on a little bit of the philosophy and the theology of the existence of the universe. There's a little bit of, you know, fun anecdotes and history in there, and then aliens and Area 51. And so I really wanted to try and write a hit all the big topics that people actually want to know and not get too bogged down into, okay, well, how do we work out what right ascension is, and how do we work out where the elliptical plane is, and how do we measure the angle? I thought, okay, well, that stuff is interesting, but if you just want kind of, you know, an overview of all the cool space topics, all the fun stuff, I wanted to write that book, and that's very much the aim of it, to just sort of hit all the big, weird, fun stuff. So that's really nice to hear that it has succeeded. Thank you.
Well, but we'll get into more of the topics of the book in just a moment. But I'd like to also know a bit about your origin story. I saw that you were this always sounds so classic, raised by missionaries in Africa. Tell us a bit about, you know, that background and how you became interested in these scientific topics.
So the two are, I suppose some psychoanalysts might speculate that the two were related. To my knowledge, that they are separate things. But, you know, it is true. I was raised on a missionary compound in a town called Jos, which is in Nigeria. And I was there for sort of several years growing up. I have sort of, you know, scattered memories of it because I was quite young at the time. But so, you know, apparently when I was there, I used to speak one of the Nigerian dialects called Hausa. I do not remember this at all. So I grew up there and I was raised on a missionary compound. My parents were missionaries, and so, but then I sort of went back to the UK, which is where my sort of family's from originally. And getting into science, it was a multi-step process. The first obvious point I can think of is my father. My dad's a very technically minded guy. He's very curious about the world, and he sort of encouraged me, ask questions, try and find out what's going on. So he kind of fostered a sense of, you know, be curious, don't just sort of accept things at face value, try and find out what's going on. He always kind of encouraged me to never settle for a simple explanation, always go one level deeper. So he kind of, you know, set the stage. Then when I was in high school, I was very fortunate. I had a series of great science teachers. You know, you always remember the first teacher to get you fired up about a subject. For me, it was a man named Mr. Evans, and Mr. Evans sort of got me interested in science properly. And then I went to university and just sort of became very passionate about it. So I don't think that the two are necessarily related per se, but it's definitely my father is ultimately to credit. So if you're listening, thanks, Dad.
Uh-huh. Well, and before we go any further, we need to agree, you and I, that the greatest movie ever made contains the line, "Captain, there be whales here."
Well, as you've read the book, so you know, the book is absolutely flooded with Star Trek references. I'm wearing a Star Trek t-shirt now as we speak. Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home, is the one being referred to there, is probably the best one. It's probably the best of the movies. For me, that's definitely the best one of the original series. The Next Generation best one, I'd go with First Contact, personally. But as sci-fi movies go, it is hard to top Star Trek IV. If I was with my serious hat on, I might, you know, say something like 2001, A Space Odyssey.
That's not fun. Star Trek 4
is just gravitas, but it doesn't have you know, sort of whales, Mr. Scott, whales, I'm back to people, sir. It doesn't have that, and it doesn't have transparent aluminum.
No.
And it doesn't have sort of Chekhov breaking into an American nuclear missile facility asking, "Where are your nuclear vessels?" It doesn't have that. So it perhaps Star Trek 4 does have one up on that.
And Spock's nerve pinch on a punk rocker. I mean,
oh,
you know,
that
come
is
on.
Great. Yes,
you know,
that is a cracking movie.
So it's just way too fun. You know,
it's definitely my favorite Star Trek movie. Star Trek, yeah. And actually, it's interesting that you mentioned that. That was probably that's probably the earliest movie I can remember seeing. So it's very interesting that you said that. The earliest film I remember seeing as a child was Star Trek IV, and I was just hooked. So I was definitely a science fiction fan before I was a science fan, and that's quite common, actually. A lot of nerdy people like me get into sci-fi first, and then they kind of go, well, what's the real version of this? So I was definitely more into Star Trek before I got into the real physics of stars. So that's very sort of an appropriate reference there, very appropriate reference.
Yeah, well, we better talk about your book. But I did enjoy those references very much. Because Star Trek is a lot of fun, and so is your book.
Right.
The opening is where it caught my attention, because you open up with talking about something that you would not think would be in this book. It's about people that think the Earth is flat, flat earthers.
Indeed, flat earthers. I start with that.
Yeah, and I found that fascinating. But my favorite part, and one of the things I love in this book, are your appendices.
Thank you.
I really loved. Could you give us the basic argument that you use? Where here's an experiment you can do that shows that the Earth couldn't possibly be flat.
Sure. So I start with talking about flat earthers, because flat earthism is, I think, absolutely fascinating. And the wrong way to deal with a flat earther, or some people use it, the flat, is to say, "Oh, you're wrong. You're stupid." Who is going to be convinced by that? You know, that's just insulting them. And actually, the majority of flat earthers I've spoken to, they're not stupid. They're really not. They have some misguided understandings of things, but that doesn't make them stupid. And, you know, we all make mistakes. So I talk about some experiments that you can do. So one of the simplest experiments is to boil water at different locations around the world. So if the Earth is flat, then there are two options. Either the atmosphere above us is dome-shaped, or it's infinite. Now, if it's dome-shaped, then that means there would be more air above the northern latitudes than the southern ones. So air would be pressing down more on water at the North Pole than the South Pole. So if the Earth is flat and it's a dome shape, then if you boil water at different places, it will boil at different temperatures. So I'm ever so sorry, I don't know Fahrenheit, so you'll have to forgive me.
212 is boiling.
212, okay, so 212 is the boiling point of water in Fahrenheit in America. So if you boil it in, say, you know, Montana, and then you boil it in Texas, if there is a dome of air, there should be less air above southern Texas, so the air will, the water will boil at a slightly lower temperature, because you don't have to heat it as much, because there's not as much atmosphere above you that you're fighting against. So, okay, so that's what you do. But if the air is infinite above us, then the altitude wouldn't affect it, because wherever you are, you've got the same amount of air above you. But what you find is that as you go to the top of hills and mountains, water boils at lower temperatures. So the fact that the temperature of boiling water is dependent on altitude rather than latitude, the only explanation for that is that there is a constant height to the atmosphere above us. And the only way of having that is if it is spherical. There would be no other way geometrically of making that work. So the Earth has to be round, because water always boils at 212 wherever you are, unless you go higher up and then it drops. If the Earth was flat, it would be the other way around.
Yeah, I loved that. I thought that was a great explanation, and it kind of says it all. Let's take a short break, but stay with us as we continue our conversation about a pretty big topic, the universe, with Tim James, author of the new book, Astronomical. If you're just joining us, our guest is Tim James. His new book, Astronomical, is a very lively tour through some of the most fascinating topics in the scientific exploration of the cosmos. One of the things I really enjoyed about this book, and thinking about my hero, Carl Sagan, who said, you know, the cosmos, the universe is all there ever was or is or ever will be. And in my Tim James universe, the universe is very big, very old, and very weird.
Yes, I perhaps don't have quite the grandeur of Professor Sagan, but Professor Sagan's books don't tend to have quite as many sort of penis jokes. So,
Yeah, well, big. I love the very big, very old, very weird, because it is
absolutely. No, my books on they're definitely written without kind of the sort of the elegance of Carl Sagan's language, but my books are kind of a bit deliberately a bit silly.
Yeah, it's fun. It's what makes it fun. And one of the things I really, really got a kick out of was your description of the Big Bang Theory. Could you tell us a bit about some of the fun stuff in the discovery of the Big Bang? And like, sure, for example, the white dielectric material.
Oh, yes. No, I know what you're referring to. I mean, mm-hmm. I don't want to sort of completely give away the farm here because I want people to buy the book. But yeah, absolutely. So at the time, the Big Bang Theory is fairly recently accepted in a lot of people. It was accepted within their lifetime. So originally you had two hypotheses, you know, so explanations without evidence, the Big Bang hypothesis and the steady state hypothesis. And originally everyone was in favor of this idea called the steady state hypothesis, including Einstein, incidentally. So, you know, it's not just because you're a great scientist doesn't mean you're always right. And the two people who discovered that the Big Bang hypothesis had evidence to it, in other words, upgraded it to theory status, Penzias and Wilson, their names were, discovered it entirely by accident. So if the Big Bang is true, if the Big Bang happened, then the entire universe should be glowing. There should be light left over from the Big Bang, but it wouldn't be at a visible frequency. So there should be light everywhere. Everywhere you point a telescope, there should be light, but just not visible to human eyes. Penzias and Wilson were sort of studying the sky with their telescope called the Big Horn antenna. And they discovered there was interference. There was like a hiss everywhere that they pointed the telescope. And they got this kind of, I thought, oh, that's a bit. So they went out and looked at the antenna, and there were two pigeons that had made a home inside the antenna. So they thought, all right. And pigeons being pigeons had coated the inside of the antenna with a substance now, and they had to come up with a way to describe it when they were writing up the research, and they can't just say pigeon crap because that's what it was. So they described it as a white dielectric material. Dielectric means it doesn't conduct electricity, and in the research it's even in sort of quotation marks as a white dielectric material. So they thought, oh well, it's pigeon poop, that's what we're detecting. So they boxed the pigeons up, sent them away, cleaned off the telescope, but the pigeons were homing pigeons, so they flew right back and set up home again, once again in the antenna. So unfortunately, the dark side of this story is one of them, they've never revealed who, one of them went out and shot the pigeons. They then went back and carried out their readings, and the hiss was still there, which means basically those pigeons died for nothing. So they did get a Nobel Prize out of it, but they will always have the death of two pigeons on their conscience. But they realized that the hiss they were discovering everywhere, that they were detecting, was not interference. They had discovered this really faint light, the afterglow of the Big Bang. That's what they had discovered. So, you know, when sort of like there's a loud noise in a room and your ears ring for a little bit afterwards, effectively they discovered the Big Bang's equivalent of that, this kind of hum. And that's what it was. So the evidence that the Big Bang Theory was true, that made it the theory, was originally mistaken for pigeon excrement.
Well, or you could at least say that those pigeons gave their lives for science.
They did. That would be the way to say it. Yeah, so, yeah. You know, so Penzias and Wilson were awarded the Nobel Prize, so they got gold. And the pigeons were awarded with lead, just very quickly moving lead.
Yes. Well, the Big Bang that name is one of the things that I've always been fascinated by in the history of science by Dr. Fred Hoyle.
Yeah,
that he, you know,
the
didn't like
possible
it
possible name for it. It wasn't big. It didn't go bang.
There's nothing big and there was no bang. So that's
absolutely,
like, that's the dumbest possible name for it. What would be a good name?
But that's the thing. Fred Hoyle called it that because he was making fun of it. He was mocking it. And, you know, he says the idea of the universe starting with a big bang, like a girl popping out of a cake at a birthday party, is nonsense. And so the name caught on. So everyone calls it the name that was originally designed to make fun of it.
What would be a good name for it?
Probably the everything stretch, or the everything expand, or the tiny stretch would be a better name for it, but that doesn't sound quite as grandiose as the Big Bang, but the tiny stretch theory is closer to what it is, because the universe was tiny and it started stretching in all directions.
Well, one of the things that I've always found fascinating about space and time is this, the concept of dimensions. Mm-hmm. We live in a three-dimensional world plus the dimension of time. Mm-hmm. And with the three dimensions, you know, there's up and down and there's, you know, right and left.
Yeah.
And if you, you know, use mathematics, there's positive and negative. But in when you look at time, there's no such thing as negative time. The arrow of time, that dimension only goes in one way. And that was, I've always found that to be, you know, I guess it has to be that way in order to have cause and effect. But it's an interesting aspect. And you get into some really cool discussions about dimensions and, you know, what all these possibilities are.
So physicists tend to talk about the universe as being three plus one dimensions. They usually, rather than saying four dimensions, they say three plus one to signify that time is an outlier. It's a slightly odd dimension. So we are three plus one dimensional beings observing a three plus one dimensional universe. But there is absolutely no reason whatsoever. There is no reason whatsoever to assume that that's it, that that's the limit. There could absolutely be higher dimensions that we just don't detect. To claim that there were no higher dimensions, it effectively, it would be sort of like someone who is born colorblind saying these are the only colors that exist, saying these are the only colors that exist. And you think, okay, but yes, that's because, you know, your eye is limited, can't see the colors, those colors aren't there. In the same way, the entire human species might very well be dimensionally limited. So we can detect three dimensions of space and one of time, but there's absolutely nothing in physics which says there has to be three dimensions of space and one dimension of time. And in fact, including extra dimensions actually helps explain some things which are rather difficult to wrap your head around otherwise. So the idea of higher dimensions, it's not a problem for the physics. It's only a problem for our minds. It's only a problem when we try and visualize it and wrap our heads around it. But there's nothing to say it can't be that way. And in fact, there's some evidence to suggest actually it would kind of make sense if it was, and we're just unaware of it. So the idea of higher dimensions, it kind of, people object to it on an emotional level, and I certainly do. I feel that there can't be higher dimensions. My emotions tell me there can't be. My gut tells me there can't be. But that is only coming from my limited human experience of having only experienced three spatial dimensions and one dimension of time. It would be like if you spent your entire life eating Hershey bars and then someone tells you that Kit Kats exist. You think, oh, there's no such thing as Kit Kats. Nonsense. There's only Hershey bars. And you think, yeah, that's just because you've only ever experienced one type. There is absolutely no reason to say that's it. And certainly in things like string theory, it becomes quite useful to talk about higher dimensions of space. And now you talk about time not having a reverse dimension, but there's sort of whispers that maybe it doesn't have to be, you know, positive in time. That there are sort of, you know, faint, you know, sort of edges of the vision that maybe we might have to one day talk about negative time, possibly. There's a few kind of fringe outlier ideas there that are being discussed. So, you know, depending on who you talk to, higher dimensions are either total nonsense or they are something which really makes sense and helps us explain some things that we can't otherwise.
And once again, fun to contemplate. And
one
caution that I always give people is that when the more you study science and nature, the more you realize that human intuition and what we call common sense sometimes is not your best guide to understanding how the world works.
Oh, totally. So Leonard Susskind, who actually let me go one step further back than that. So Richard Feynman, who's my favorite scientist. Richard Feynman said that basically the human brain evolved to forage for berries and get bananas from trees, and we're stretching it to the limit by trying to understand the shape and structure of the universe. And so we shouldn't be surprised when it doesn't work and when we can't quite grasp it. And then his student, Leonard Susskind, his student, who is the godfather of string theory, he has a wonderful quotation which says, unexpected surprises are the rule in science, not the exception. In other words, the more you study science, you have to get used to weird ideas. If you like comfortable, simple, small ideas, you're not going to like science, because the universe is not built to make comfortable sense to human intuition. It's very much outside of things that we can sort of easily visualize. We just have to accept sometimes this is just the way it is. It doesn't appear that way. I mean, you know, to our senses, yeah, the Earth appears flat. To our senses, the stars all appear to be tiny points of white light, and they all look like they're the same thing. And it appears that the sun is going round us. And, you know, that's certainly how our senses are, you know, reading reality. Science really is a way of breaking away from common sense. Science is a way of trying to not limit ourselves by our, you know, rather pathetic human senses. I mean, so the human spectrum of vision. So we can see the colors, you know, red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, violet. But there are colors either side of that we can't see. The entire sort of visible spectrum, we can see less than a tenth of 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 a percent of the number of colors that there actually are in the universe. And we might not like that our senses are kind of limited, but to be a scientist is to kind of, it's very humble. You have to kind of accept the universe is bigger and weirder than I can comfortably digest. You know, you have to kind of, you stare immensity in the face every day as a scientist. Every single day, you're dealing with things that do not make sense intuitively. And it really teaches you to be humble in the face of the cosmos, to kind of be reminded, wow, the universe is way, way weirder than my simple senses are trying to tell me.
And there's no thing in the universe that's way weirder than black holes. And
black holes are absolutely sort of up there in the pantheon of the weirdest thing. You know, you list the top 10 weirdest things in science. Black holes are definitely, they're making everyone's top 10. They are absolutely baffling in so many ways.
Well, and what's really cool about black holes to me, and you make it very, very clear in your book, is that the big problem in physics is to try to marry these two ideas of how the universe works. One is Einstein's general theory of relativity that deals with, you know, massive objects like the sun and the Earth and gravity, things on the largest scale. And it's been, you know, time and time again tested and shown to be absolutely a masterpiece of thought.
Definitely works.
And oh, again, one of my favorite appendices of yours is the grown-up version of Einstein's equation, the grown-up one. Everybody knows E equals MC squared, but the general relativity equation, you break it down and explain
it's a beast.
It is a beast.
Yeah, I do that in at the end of all, because I kind of, the books are non-mathematical, very deliberately. I don't want to sort of, you know, get sort of stuck in the quagmire of mathematics. So all three of my books, it's science without having to know a whole bunch of mathematics. But I always in the appendices put a couple of the equations, and just for people who are curious, well, what does this actually look like? How do these equations actually, you know, lock together? So I do include, you know, the Einstein field equation, equations, I should say, at the back in the appendix with a kind of a, okay, this is what this bit means.
A little primer.
If you're interested, and so if you want to go that far, absolutely give it a go. But if you kind of just like, no, I'll just trust that it works, you don't have to read that.
Okay, well, then on the other hand, in the realm of the very, very small, how atoms work and how, you know, the technology that is allowing us to have this conversation and record it right now depends on our understanding of the quantum mechanical atom and the world of quantum mechanics, the very, very small. But when, you know, physicists try to marry these two worldviews, universal views, the things never seem to work out, and the twain shall not meet, it seems. But that is the goal, is to try to figure out, you know, come up with the grand theory of everything.
That is the idea. That's the goal, to get the TOE, the theory of everything. Because you've got sort of general relativity, which says, okay, the universe is definitely like this, and every experiment we've ever done has confirmed it. And then you have on the other side, you have another branch of physics with quantum field theory. And every time we've ever tested that, that has come back saying, yep, this is definitely correct. This absolutely works. And quantum field theory has special relativity in it. So you can have special relativity, that's fine. But the problem is, okay, so quantum field theory is saying the universe is definitely like this, and all the experiments say it's true. And general relativity says the universe is definitely like this, and all the experiments say it's true, but they both say the other one can't be true. So what do you do with that when you've got sort of, you know, one theory saying this is how the universe is and it's not like that, and the other one saying nope, it's definitely like this, not like that, and they're both correct? How do you even begin to approach that problem? How do you even begin to approach that problem?
Yeah, and but it's in black hole. The study of black holes and what's going on there
is where these two sort of disciplines they try to mate. And we have to try and sort of quantify the offspring.
Tim, is it necessary that there be a grand unified theory? Do these two, you know, the ideas, do we have to have that? Or is it even possible? Or should we even ask for that question?
No, it's a very good question. So the grand unified theory is something very slightly different from the theory of everything. So theory of everything is an attempt to unify quantum mechanics with general relativity. The GUT or the GUTS, it's a slightly different thing. But, you know, the ultimate question, should there be a, you know, one answer? And so I'm going to, again, if you don't mind, I'm going to quote Richard Feynman on this again. And Richard Feynman was again asked that question. And he said, well, nature's going to come out the way she is. And it might be that there is a simple answer for everything. And that would be very nice to discover. But it might be more like an onion when there's millions and millions of layers and you just get tired of looking at it. But nature's going to come out the way she is, and we've just got to go along for the ride. So why do we think there might be a theory of everything at the end? Why might there be? So there's no obvious law of physics which says that there has to be. But what there is there's a pattern. So the pattern in physics has always been that two separate areas end up being explained by one single idea. So if you go back to sort of 1687, you've got Sir Isaac Newton, arguably the inventor of what we would now call physics. And so he was, the story goes, you know, the apple didn't actually hit him on the head. That was a myth started by his niece, Catherine Conduit. But he did see an apple fall. That is true. So he saw the apple fall and he thought, okay, well, why does that fall? Okay, well, it's heavy. And then he thought, well, why doesn't the moon fall? The moon is clearly heavier than apple. What's stopping the moon from falling? And he started thinking about, well, we've got all these laws to describe how stuff in the sky moves, and a separate set of laws to describe how stuff on the Earth moves. What if they were actually both sides of the same thing? And so he came up with this idea of the laws of physics that apply to the heavens and the Earth. So you have two separate realms. You've got day-to-day mechanics and astronomy. Newton synthesized them. He found an underlying explanation, and they are both sides of the same thing. Wind forwards a little bit, and you've got Michael Faraday and James Clerk Maxwell. And there's magnetism and electricity, and they seem like separate things, but you study them and you discover actually, oh, they're both parts of the same theory. And then you've got the behavior of radioactive materials, you've got the behavior of waves, and you've got the behavior of the elements. And they all look like they're separate things. You think, okay, right, so you've got radioactivity, that's Marie Curie over here, and you've got wave physics, that's Schrodinger over there, and you've got sort of elemental physics, that's, you know, Humphrey Davy over here. And then it turns out, in sort of the middle of the 20th century, they are all part of the same thing, particle physics. And the story of science has been a repeated journey of, we find separate areas of everyday life that actually can be explained by one underlying theory. The same theory can explain everything. And we repeatedly do this. And this is what sort of we've at least discovered so far. Two disparate areas turn out to be two aspects of the same phenomenon. So things that you thought, well, isn't that and isn't that this, turn out to be actually they're both aspects of this. And we've now got it down to two. So we've now basically got all of science down to two basic ideas. You've got quantum field theory, which is the theory of nearly everything, and then general relativity, which is the theory of space, time, and gravity. And there is absolutely no reason to assume that there will be a theory of everything. There may very well not be. It may be that they don't marry, and that actually we just have to live with the fact that there are two sets of laws of physics going around us. There's nothing in nature which says there is one alphabet to reality. There is one language that the universe is written in. There's no reason to assume there absolutely has to be. But the pattern so far has been two things which seem separate turn out to be, you know, two sides of the same coin. And that's kind of why we're looking. But you're absolutely right. It's a very fair question. Why do we think there is something? We don't know for definite. So a lot of scientists are kind of hoping that there will be everything, but we may get to the point where we've tried absolutely everything and it turns out there isn't. There are two candidates at the moment for that, string theory and loop quantum gravity, but neither of those are finished or work yet. So, but yeah, there might not be. There might not be a theory of everything.
We're going to take a short break, but when we come back, you'll hear more of my interview with Tim James as we talk about his new book, Astronomical. I'm Dave Shlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening. Let's get back now to our visit with Tim James. He's the UK-based author of the new book, Astronomical, From Quarks to Quasars, The Science of Space at Its Strangest. And the string theory is something that's kind of difficult for people to wrap their minds around, and the mathematics in it.
Yep, string theory is difficult for string theorists to wrap their minds around.
The mathematics of it, is, when you just look at it, is just like, oh my gosh. And for our listeners, your readers, that you don't need to understand the mathematics.
No, absolutely not.
Tim's done the heavy lifting for you, and gives you just. But could you give us your elevator speech? If some, you know, my grandma wants to know, what is string theory, and what could I tell her over Thanksgiving dinner?
So string theory is one of the possible ways to unify quantum mechanics and general relativity, but it is by no means a completed theory. We don't have a complete theory. But string theory says, rather than there being, you know, hundreds of different types of fundamental particle, you know, up quarks, down quarks, strange quarks, neutrinos, gluons, WZs, Higgs bosons, rather than there being lots and lots of different types, there is one thing, there is one type of substance, which is like a string of sort of the basic energy, the basic matter. And basically this string can twist itself and vibrate itself in different directions. And when it coils up and vibrates in one particular arrangement, it starts acting like what we would think of as an electron. When it uncoils and rewraps itself, it starts acting like what we would think of as a photon, a particle of light. So the idea is that rather than there being a particle zoo, hundreds of different types of particles, which there currently are, there is just one type of thing, a string, but it behaves differently. So it wraps and coils into different shapes. And what we perceive as different particles, what we perceive as different objects, are actually the same object behaving differently. And one of the ways, if you take this idea of a string, one of the ways you can get strings to vibrate, it makes them look like a particle of gravity called a graviton. So it is possible to take this idea of a string and wrap it around and vibrate it left, right, center. And there is one particular configuration where it forms a loop. And that, if it really happened, would look to us like a particle of gravity. And so this might be a way of explaining all the particles that we have in quantum mechanics and quantum field theory, all of the hundreds of particles there. And the much simpler view of general relativity, string theory might be a way of doing it. Now, where this came from was three scientists called Holger Bleck-Nielsen, Leonard Susskind, and Yuichiro Nambu, who discovered that there are certain particles that when you spin them, they behave as if they are on an elastic string. And there's a very interesting piece of evidence called the Regge trajectory, R-E-G-G-E, Regge trajectory. It might be pronounced Regge trajectory. I think it's Regge trajectory. And if you assume that particles are actually made of these elastic string things, it explains the Reggie trajectory, this observation you get where you spin a particle around and it starts acting like an elastic band. And these three scientists noticed this, Susskind, Nielsen and Nambu. They noticed this and thought, well, this is interesting. We can model particles as if they were kind of stretchy springs. Well, what else can we do? Can we model other particles if they're string? And that's where the string theory idea came from. So when people say there's no evidence for string theory, because you'll sometimes say, oh, there's no evidence, that's not strictly speaking true. There is one kind of clue, this Reggie trajectory evidence. And Susskind and co. noticed this. And so you can model certain particles as if they were strings, particles called gluons. And so they started thinking, well, could we do it with other particles? And on paper, you can. On paper, you can model some other particles, but no one has yet come up with a version of string theory that models all the particles. So usually a string theory will say, okay, well, we've managed to come up with a string theory that explains gluons and gravitons or electrons and photons, but nothing else. And when you consider how many different types of particles there are actually, here's a sort of a scary number. There are at a minimum 10 to the power of 500 possible parameters for string theory. 10 to the power of five, that's wow. 10, not 10 times, 10 to the power of 500.
Yeah.
So you think like a one with like 500 zeros after it. That's how many possible parameters for string theory there could be. And one of them might be right. So that's basically where string theory is at the moment. So it's the idea that everything is made of little strings and they vibrate, create different things. And if it's true, we can model gravity. But the problem is no one has got it to work to explain everything. So it's a candidate for the theory of everything, but it is by no means it developed enough for us to even test it.
Yeah, it's again, one of those fascinating things to, one of the fun things about your book is it's just a cool thing to think about. Well, we can't let you go without talking about aliens.
Oh, absolutely, yes.
Can't. And I don't want you to give too much away. I will tell the listeners that you do explain everything about Area 51 with a bunch of top secret information. So you want to read the book to get all that.
Well, sure. I have to. Yeah, interesting. It was a funny story about that because when I was doing research for the book, I was obviously, you know, I was digging around looking for information on, you know, because, you know, everyone, what's going on in Area 51? And the information is out there if you know where to look. But there was a particular bit that I was told to rewrite, and I'm not allowed to tell you what it is. I can tell you it's not that there's aliens there. It's not that. But there was a bit that I was told you need to rewrite that. You cannot put that in print. I'm not allowed to repeat what it is, unfortunately.
Now I want to go back and read that section again and try to figure out what it is. Yeah.
So there is a bit. So, you know, if you go looking, there is information there. So I do talk about what's going on if you want, because actually it's the information is now out there. There was a Freedom of Information Act request made by a guy called Jeffrey Rickelstein, I think was his name, in about 2012. And actually a lot of documents from Area 51 have since been declassified. So actually we do kind of know what was going on there. But I was heavily told to reword one particular section lest I get in trouble with the American military.
Yeah, well, and there's been this latest fascination in this country with what they're now, or what they call unidentified aerial phenomenon instead of UFOs, and yeah, it was on 60 Minutes, and you know, it's like, well, making the leap to those things are aliens, is, you know, instead of something we just don't understand.
That's identifying them. That's the thing. To open with unidentified is another way of saying we don't know what they are.
We don't know what they are.
We've seen some weird stuff in the sky. And we have seen weird stuff in the sky. The sky is weird. We see weird stuff in the sky all the time. But to go from I saw a strange thing up there to making probably the most profound discovery in the history of science that we're not alone in the universe, it's too big of a leap. You need more evidence than, that looks a bit strange.
Yeah. Well, the last thing I would like you to talk about, because you explain it really well, is the famous wow signal.
Ah, yes, the wow signal.
Could you tell us a little bit about the wow signal?
Yes. So the wow signal was back in, I think, 1973. So the big ear antenna, which I think is in Ohio, but I could be wrong. Anyway, so we received a radio signal from space, roughly around about where the Sagittarius constellation is. We received this signal, and this signal has all the hallmarks of having been artificially generated. So naturally generated radio signals, we know what they look like. We know exactly what they're like. We can quantify them. But we received for a very short period of time, I think it was 86 seconds, which was the amount of time that the antenna was pointed in the direction, we received something that looks exactly the way an artificially generated signal was. And it's called the WOW signal because the scientist Jerry Amon, I think, Jerry Amon wrote on the printout, WOW, and he writes WOW in red pen because, you know, it would be like, imagine, okay, so imagine you had like a 1,000 page book, and someone told you that if there was aliens, then there should be the letter G on page 387, third sentence down. You open the book, page 387, third sentence, and you find the letter G exactly in the place they said it would be. It's a spooky coincidence. So it's exactly what an artificial signal would look like. Does this prove that there are aliens? Unfortunately not. I would love it to. I'd love to be able to say, that's it, case closed. But as a scientist, you need a little bit more than that, unfortunately, because the signal has never been repeated. So here's the thing. On the one hand, well, if it's a naturally occurring phenomenon, it should be occurring all the time, right? If it's a naturally occurring phenomenon, we should be getting it, you know, every few years by whatever's generating it. And it's never been repeated, which suggests artificial. But flip that argument around. If it's artificially generated, then how come they haven't sent the signal again? If it really was a bunch of aliens sending out a signal saying, hello, we are here, we are here, we are here, how come they've never repeated it? So the WOW signal it's one of the more convincing bits of evidence for alien life. So UFOs, unfortunately, that's not convincing evidence for alien life. That's just convincing evidence for weird stuff in the sky. But the WOW signal is one of the bits of evidence which you can take seriously. You really can sit up and go, oh, that's interesting. That's odd. We wouldn't expect that to happen another way. So the WOW signal is, if you know, there's two or three really strong bits of evidence. That's what, you know, the Alan Hills meteorite is another, but the WOW signal is one of the most convincing ones that even hard-nosed skeptics will raise an eyebrow at that and think, okay, that's interesting. Tell me more about that. But we just don't know. There's too many unknowns there. But I'm optimistic. I'm hopeful. I think it would be cool if that was what it was. We've sent signals back, incidentally. So hopefully, you know, who knows? Maybe there's a signal currently on its way to Earth right now, and maybe tomorrow we'll get a reply. Who knows?
Yeah, it's awfully far away. So it takes that radio transmission a long time to get here.
Yeah, I think I say in the book, I say it was launched when whatever generated the signal would have launched it toward Earth at roughly the time Walt Whitman was composing Leaves of Grass.
Yeah.
At roughly that time was when it was sent, and we got it in the 70s. So it's going to take another 100 and whatever it is, 60 odd years to get back to Sagittarius. So who knows? Maybe we'll get a reply. Well, maybe we won't. We don't know.
It arrived in 77, which is the year I graduated high school. So I think it was meant for me.
Yeah. I mean, and the thing, it's one of those, it could go either way. It really could. It's very exciting to think about it. And either we'll get something or we won't. But every few years, someone comes up with some new sort of non-artificial, you know, explanation. You know, every few years someone says, oh, actually we can explain it by this, and it never works. Someone else always points out, no, that wouldn't explain it because of x y and z, and the debate goes on with the WOW signal.
And that's the fun thing about all of this, and in your book, is it's all so many mysteries that, you know, and you point out at the very, in one of your conclusions, and something that I've always felt is like, would you want the universe to be any other way than mysterious? But it's like, do we want it to be like going to 7-Eleven and getting a Diet Coke?
Well, precisely. I mean, your podcast is called Blue Dot. And of course, you know, that comes from, of course, the famous pale blue dot photograph. And I've shown the pale blue dot photograph to people, and some people find it depressing because they look at how small the Earth is. and how big the universe is, and they think, well, that makes us very unimportant. But I think it's the wrong way to look at it, because the universe is big and exciting, and it's full of strangeness and weirdness and mystery. The universe would be boring if we already had all the answers. The universe would be boring if Earth was flat and we were living inside a dome, you know, with stars stuck to it, you know, the Ptolemaic view. The universe would be terribly dull if it was small and simple. So we're actually kind of lucky that the universe is huge and it's as mysterious as our brains want it to be. It's full of questions, and we're a questioning species. So the fact that the universe is as elegant and grand and beautiful and puzzling, and it's one big question mark, to me is exciting, because it means we're never going to run out of stuff to explore. And wanting to know answers is a very, very human emotion. That's what motivates Star Trek. That's what motivates scientists. It's what's out there, what is going on. And we're lucky that the universe is as fascinating as it is. Either we're very, very, very lucky because it happens to be like this, or if you happen to believe in a god, a creator deity of some sort, then this is God's way of saying, I'm big and yeah, you're small, come and look for me. So whichever way you personally philosophically fall on that question, the universe is big and interesting.
Tim, it's been just lovely talking to you, and it's a great, great book. I'm, like I said, I plan on giving it to lots of friends for Christmas, and I highly recommend it. It's a very cool book.
It's been really nice talking to you. Actually, you've been overly complimentary, so thank you so much.
Thanks again to our guest, Tim James. His new book, Astronomical, From Quarks to Quasars, The Science of Space at its Strangest, is published by Pegasus Books and available from most major booksellers. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio in beautiful and talented Northern California. If you want to revisit, share, or check out past episodes, you can do just that on our website, mynspr.org. And while you're at it, subscribe to our podcast so you never miss an episode. You can do that on our website, the NPR One app, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Our theme music is by Matt Schultz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Matt Fidler. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.